you're back. That makes you a constant listener. That makes me really happy. Thank you for coming back. This is Nick DeOlias. You can follow me on Twitter at Nick DeOlias. You can also click on my website when you've got the time or the interest, nickdeolias.com. Always posting new content on it. Please give it a look. And this is our next installment of our podcast, The Far Middle, where we have been discussing topics that are chapters in my upcoming book, The Leech. Today, we are going to be discussing an entity that, quite frankly, I never in my wildest dreams would have envisioned writing about or publishing a podcast with respect to not too long ago. And that entity is the Federal Reserve, or the Fed. Most people hear the Fed and they think it's a very complicated, obtuse entity that's in the background. So why the focus on it, the importance of it from my perspective? Well, the answer to that stems from the importance of money in our society, in our culture, and obviously certainly in our economy. When you focus upon money, culturally, we give it a bad rap, or individuals who do so a bad rap. You can be accused of being greedy, materialistic, superficial, all those negative connotations. When you think about it, however, money truly drives a lot of who we are as a society and the quality of life that we've been able to derive for ourselves because of the importance that we place upon money. Don't take my word for it. Take the words of two thought leaders from the past, who I've quoted in prior podcasts that I think you know by now I'm a big fan of. One being Milton Friedman. Milton Friedman said that money is much too serious a matter to be left to the central bankers. We're going to see that he was absolutely right on that thought. The other being Ayn Rand, who said, watch money. Money is the barometer of a society's virtue. So if you take Rand's quote, where money really is the barometer of society and its virtue, and then you link upon it or follow it with Friedman's view that money is much too serious a matter to be left to the central bankers or the bureaucrats, now you can see at least the setup as to why the Federal Reserve, unfortunately, from my perspective, has played and is playing currently an outsized role when it comes to money and thus economy, society, quality of life. You can see the role, the impact the Fed's having just on the data. It's really striking. Look at the numbers when it comes to balance sheets, what the Federal Reserve holds on its balance sheet or other central banks. Fed right now balance sheet, if you just look at a time progression, in 2006, not that long ago, under $1 trillion of domestic securities on the Fed balance sheet, went to $4 trillion in 2015. And today it's $7 trillion, which just blows my mind. So it went from under $1 trillion in 06 to $7 trillion today. Banks, which have to follow a lot of the rules and mandates when it comes to reserves that the Fed sets, it has more in Fed-induced reserves than they have in industrial and commercial loans. That's an amazing statistic for the banks. I'm talking about commercial banks. If you look at the big four central banks on the globe, so you've got the Federal Reserve here, and you've got the Bank of Japan, you've got the UK Central Bank, the EU Central Bank, you add those four up, $11 trillion of financial assets on their balance sheets. And that's before all the moves that these different central banks have begun to initiate when it comes off of the pandemic and what they can do or what they say they need to do based on justification of pandemic measures. Now, when you've got these staggering numbers in the trillions, it's not a surprise that the Fed moves the stock market. It moves commodity markets. It moves bond markets. You can see it in the S&P 500. Over half of the rise in the S&P 500 from 2008 to 2016, it came from days when the Federal Open Market Commission, the FOMC, had decision days. And if you look at a wider data set from 1995 to 2016, and this is amazing to me, the S&P 500, the index did 10 times better on FOMC trading days than on non-FOMC trading days. So you culminate that. Only 3% of your trading days out there from 95 to 2016 have been FOMC days. But guess what? Over a third, 35% of the S&P's total return over that period came from those FOMC days. It's not a coincidence. Statistically, it's a certainty. And I quote these data up through 2016. I didn't go beyond that for, say, 17 up till now, because the Fed has become so large and so massive with how it's impacting markets that there's no point in even assessing these data. It has become the market. It doesn't move the market anymore. It is the market or markets. That is, of course, not a good thing. What's interesting about this, when you look at what the Federal Reserve defines as its own mission or its goals, you go to the website, it says that its goals are to set the nation's monetary policy to promote the objectives of maximum employment, stable prices, and moderate long-term interest rates. Now, you look at some of those descriptors in that definition of safer and flexible and stable and moderate, you would think that the Fed is a sort of nice and easy entity or steady as she goes, and that's how it would govern and fulfill its mission and goals. Obviously, not the case. The Federal Reserve no longer serves as a passive governor of the economy. Instead, it's an active and a massive, and in many instances, the largest participant in a whole range of key market sectors. Today, the Federal Reserve drives the economy to the point where it is the economy. Very interesting, contrasting that to its definition of goals and its mission. An interesting facet of the goals of the Fed is that there are three there that are stated. However, you always hear about the dual mandate, and the dual mandate being maximum employment and stable prices. But that there is that third, and you can read it in the Federal Reserve Act of 1977 when the mandate of the Fed was expanded. And the third one, of course, is moderate long-term interest rates. What is a joke, of course, is looking at our current situation and seeing any signal of interest rates going to anything moderate over the long term anytime soon. That's because the Fed has driven interest rates to not just all-time lows when it comes to the United States, but I think all-time lows in the history of interest rates, in the history of mankind, as long as there have been things called interest rates. And free money that's emblematic of what happens when you set interest rates at zero or negative on a real basis when you compare it to inflation for extended periods of time, and you signal to markets and to individuals and to the economy that negative rates are going to be, on a real basis, the reality for the foreseeable future, it starts to seismically shift not just the pricing and valuations of assets that we spoke about. So you don't just fan the flames of a bubble economy where stocks and housing and every other asset that hinges on interest rates, which is effectively everything, gets repriced to very lofty levels that creates bubbles that will ultimately burst. But it also changes just the culture of how people behave and think and view things like saving and borrowing and debt and spending. And that might have an even longer term impact on what that means for not just the economy, but for our way of life than what the shorter term asset valuations, whether they be bubble levels or not, are doing because of interest rate policies being negative on a real basis or zero on an absolute basis. Now, instead of moderate long-term interest rates, if we've got zero interest rates or negative interest rates on a real basis versus inflation, why? What's the reason or the rationale? The reality is that Fed policy, and specifically when it comes to the cost of money, interest rates, it is aimed to redistribute trillions of dollars of value across different segments of society. Now, that redistribution and those segments of society as to who benefits and who is penalized, that's where the details will tell you much more. And if you want to know who gains from and who loses from low to zero interest rates, you just simply have to follow the money and your answers will become readily apparent. Monetary policy that delivers low to zero interest rates, that definitely benefits debtors and it clearly penalizes creditors. Now, another name for debtors or borrowers and another name for creditors are savers. Creditors, by the way, those savers, those include millions of retirees who receive a pension and those active workers who are contributing to a pension for retirement someday because they hold a financial interest with the hope that it pays out in the future. The pension, in many ways, is a savings account that is invested, and thus you got those creditors, and they are being harmed by zero to negative interest rates, as we'll see. Now, on the flip side, if you owe money, or even better yet, if you're looking to borrow more money for whatever your endeavor or your future plans are, you're going to love exceptionally low interest rates because it keeps your interest expense down and allows you to go about your business or your aimed objective. And by the way, if interest rates drop to the inflation rate or below it, you have free money. That's the nomer that we come up with of free money, because the cost of the debt that you're borrowing is lower than what inflation is doing. It's actually a smart move. Now, if you lend money And an example of that would be someone that's got a savings account, right? You're providing deposits to the bank so they can turn around and indirectly lend money to others. So if you have a savings account, you shouldn't be a fan of low interest rates because it's giving you no income, no return for your hard-earned nest egg or for the risk that you took on as a lender. And there's always risk when you basically deposit money with anything or with anybody. So zero to negative interest rates, it really does destroy the value of savings. It's a tax on savings that's hidden, but it's real. Now, who are the savers that have bank accounts and CDs, certificates of deposit, money market accounts? It's your Main Street savers. It's the mom and pop variety. Ironically, even though these are the individuals that are being harmed by Fed policy when it comes to interest rates, the prior Fed chair and our Treasury Secretary today, Janet Yellen, she famously promised to set policy and interest rates to, quote, help Main Street, not Wall Street, end quote. Now, while Main Street savers are getting hammered by the Fed with this policy, guess who's doing quite well with it? Guess who's gaining from it? It's, of course, the Wall Street big boys. They're loving it. And while the big guys park their net worth, which, of course, is sizable, in all kinds of exotic equities and hedge funds and other types of investments or alternative investment vehicles, all of those are benefiting and basically being driven to very high valuations, almost bubble levels, if not already there, from these exceptionally low interest rates. Meanwhile, the little guy, the mom and pop saver, they're getting stuck with next to nothing for their hard-earned savings. Not exactly a policy that's helping Main Street and not Wall Street. In fact, it's the exact opposite. Over time, this type of a Fed policy on interest rates and what it means to the small individual investors and what it means to us as a society, it takes its toll. Free money will erode over time the cultural values of saving and economic responsibility. It's inevitable and logical that it would do so. Now, living beyond your means used to be a cultural scarlet letter, right? Those that did, it was viewed as not something that you wanted to do for an extended period of time, and it had a negative connotation to it. Saving had a positive connotation to it. But increasingly, living beyond your means, that's a rational behavior due to where the Fed has set interest rate policies. So not only is it culturally gone from a negative to something that's viewed as a positive, logically, if you follow the numbers, you follow the math, and you act rationally, you shouldn't be a saver. You should be outspending and borrowing because the math dictates that, and in some instances, it's free money, as I said, when the interest rate level drops below the rate of inflation. So if you're a millennial or even younger, and you're just starting to start your life as an adult, what type of message is this sending from day one? It's not a positive one, and that will take a substantial amount of time to reverse. Now, there's also another big beneficiary from low to zero or negative real interest rates, and that, of course, is our U.S. federal government. Now, why is the government such a beneficiary of this Fed interest rate policy? Well, it has to do with that little thing called $27 trillion in debt and growing. And $27 trillion in debt with a continual annual outspend where it's only getting bigger, that, to put it in perspective, is over 100% of our gross domestic product. It's over 100% of GDP, the national debt. And the reality might be even worse than just counting the national debt because there are other responsibilities that the government has and promises that it made that are very debt-like. The examples are Social Security, Medicare, and the whole range of other entitlements. If you want a really scary look, a sobering look at how bad it is when it comes to government debt or debt-like responsibilities, go Google or take a look at Professor Kotlikoff from Boston University. Kotlikoff is K-O-T-L-I-K-O-F-F. Did a pretty sobering analysis of what the true financial state of our federal government is when you count all of its liabilities and all of its responsibilities. So again, zero interest rates or free money benefits one of the biggest debtors out there, which is our own government. And whether you're taking Professor Kotlikoff's approach to how you're doing the math or you're just looking at the $27 trillion in government debt, the issue of interest rates, it's very important to the government. It buys it time, but it doesn't delay the inevitable, especially if we continue to outspend and have annual budget deficits. Low interest rates will help delay the time to a default, but it's not going to avoid the need for a reckoning. And in the end, that reckoning really is only going to come about with a combination of a couple things. One is entitlement reform and substantial entitlement reform, not nibbling at the edges. Two is a reduction in government spending where we stop deficit spending and turn into at least a balanced budget approach. And three are higher taxes for everybody, by the way, not just the ultra wealthy or the rich, everyone. Those three things in combination with low interest rates would give the government a fighting chance to avoid default. But if any of those fall by the wayside, if you don't do entitlement reform or interest rates start to spike or grow, then the federal government, just looking at simple math, is going to be in a serious amount of trouble, which means we're going to be facing some serious headwinds individually and as a society. A couple of points before we leave the topic of the biggest beneficiary of low to zero interest rates, which is the federal government. One, you hear sometimes justification or defense of the debt levels in the United States on government debt by saying, well, the interest expense being, because of interest rates being so low, the interest expense as a percent of GDP is some of the lowest or the lowest that we've seen in quite some time. That is true, but interest rates inevitably are going to increase. And by the way, even with interest rates where they're at, the interest payments on the debt, which is over $300 billion a year currently, it is the fastest growing area of federal spending. And that's saying something when you look at federal spending, that you're the fastest growing area. So yes, that's true that low interest rates help, but again, it does not avoid the inevitable without that reform that we spoke about. Two, this issue of which party is in power or which president is in the White House making a difference when it comes to this issue, unfortunately, has not been true if you look at the past number of years. Doesn't matter if it was President Obama. Doesn't matter if it was President Bush right before Obama. Unfortunately, President Trump, you know, people accuse me of being an unabashed supporter of President Trump. I was an unabashed supporter of his policies when it came to regulation and deregulating. To allow creators, enablers, and servers to function more freely, and maybe tax reform, but I was not a fan of President Trump when it came to what he did with respect to the federal budget, because if you look at the math, federal budget exploded under his tenure as well. He definitely put the pedal to the metal, so to speak, with outspending and expenditure levels and not worrying about the future consequences of that and made a really tough situation net worse. And of course, with President Biden, the beat's going to continue on with just growing expenditures, growing deficits, growing debt. So we haven't seen anyone really since President Clinton that was in a position to try to do anything with respect to entitlement reform, budget deficits, balanced budgets or budget surpluses. And President Clinton hasn't been in office for quite some time. So this number is only getting bigger. The problem's only getting worse. And it doesn't seem to matter if you're a D, an R, a populist, a progressive, an elite. It's all the same. That has to change. The third thing to keep in mind with this issue of government being a beneficiary of Fed policy, this unprecedented situation, and again, it is unprecedented in the history of mankind, it's also highly immoral. Governments and their central banks, they are working together. Frankly, they're collaborating by design through these fiscal and monetary policies to set interest rates and control inflation. So governments right now all over the globe, they are selling debt to their citizens at interest rates well below inflation. They know they're doing that. That's by design. And that means they're imposing a money-losing investment on its citizenry to allow the state bureaucracy to keep growing and spending. That's a highly immoral situation and one that is completely counter to what the duty and the mission is of government. I think from that perspective, the U.S. government and the Federal Reserve working together, they're committing state-sanctioned wealth distribution as a monopoly on the scale of trillions and trillions of dollars. Beyond the biggest winners and losers when it comes to this Fed policy and zero interest rates or negative real interest rates, there are a host of other winners and losers as well. Some of them are fairly obvious. Take state and local governments. Just like the federal government, maybe the numbers aren't as large in terms of debt and deficit spending, but nevertheless, they do, state and local governments typically do outspend, and they typically do run up debt levels, and zero interest rates are a boon for them and allows them to avoid needed reform, needed decisions, and to just kick the can down the road and have someone else that succeeds you deal with the problem, hopefully before the problem doesn't get to the point where it can't be dealt with. Another group that gains by these very low interest rates are different industries that are setting up business models to feed off of free money through their consumers that are buying their products or the demand for their widgets or whatever they're doing from an industry and product perspective. So what types of industries am I talking about? Think of home builders. They're a huge example of this. That's why we have a real estate bubble because of very low interest rates. It drives when the cost of a mortgage plummets or of debt plummets to zero or goes negative on the cost spectrum, you're willing to pay more and more for properties. That drives up a bubble in housing, making it more expensive and actually in many ways acting as a regressive tax to the poorest or the most challenged in our society. But if you're a home builder, you love that because that creates more demand for your product. You can charge more and everybody's lining up to go borrow money to be able to buy the next home that steadily increases in cost as time goes on. Car companies are another big beneficiary. So whether it's the electric vehicle manufacturers or your run-of-the-mill traditional car companies, same type of thing. Auto loans plummet in cost. People are more willing to go out, buy more, buy often, buy newer, buy bigger, more expensive. And they obviously benefit from that increased demand. So if you look at these different sectors or industries in our economy, unfortunately, on the private sector side, there are a host of major sectors in our economy where profitability for them today, it directly correlates to the current Fed policy. And that is not what I would consider to be a sustainable business model by any stretch of the imagination. Now, another big beneficiary that we mentioned earlier were the big cats on Wall Street. So the hedge funds and the big investment houses and all the different institutions that are shuffling around tens or hundreds of billions of dollars, or in the aggregate, depending on which institution you look at, if it's large enough, trillions of dollars, they have loved the recent Fed policy and a zero interest rate environment for extended periods of time. Now, again, as we said earlier, that often comes to the detriment of the mom and pop saver, but nevertheless, the big entities on Wall Street are doing quite well in this environment. And where do you see this at? I think one of the interesting ones that I get fascinated with is at least a long-term investor, frankly, I guess stressed by, is looking at something like the stock market or the bond market indices. We mentioned real estate earlier, looking at bond and stock markets and seeing how inflated their valuation levels are. With the S&P 500, we gave some statistics earlier about the S&P 500 on how it moves positively on days when the Federal Reserve is acting with respect to interest rates over recent periods of time. If you look at the price to earnings ratio or the PE ratio, which is a good indicator historically of when stocks generally are cheap, when they're fairly valued or when they're overvalued, the S&P 500 has a really high price to earnings ratio compared to historical norms. Before the volatility of 2018 hit, and it's since recovered pretty much since then, the price-to-earnings ratio, the PE ratio, the S&P 500 was at about 25. That is materially higher than its historic average. And you can count on one hand how many years in the 20th century we had higher PE ratios than 25. And all of those years were after 1998. None of those years were prior to 1998. Again, from my perspective, Fed policy of zero interest rates for the foreseeable future and this concept of free money, what it's done culturally, it has created a valuation level of the stock market and frankly, the bond market. When you look at where investment grade debt is trading at, non-investment grade or junk debt is trading at, same thing. It has created a massive, unprecedented bubble. And my concern, of course, is when the bubble is going to pop and what the fallout effects will be. One of the aspects of the Fed that gives me a lot of concern and frankly bothers me is when you look at the leadership of the Fed, you can look at the chairperson at the time, you can look at the board of governors, and you can look at the bureaucrats all through the decision-making tree. And it is a massive bureaucracy, by the way, the Federal Reserve, that has grown substantially coming off of the financial crisis. Never let a good crisis go to waste. The financial crisis was a boon for the Fed when it comes to its staffing levels. But that leadership, those decision-makers, there is a massive degree of groupthink that is going on there and in backgrounds that mirror one another. It's not a very diverse, from a diversity of thought perspective, leadership team. I said in the book that the Fed leadership, it's neither nonpartisan nor bipartisan. Instead, Fed leadership is unipartisan or monopartisan, perhaps. Everybody there, they're thinking the same in both policy and ideology. That's not a good thing. The backgrounds of that leadership is really similar as well. You don't see a lot of what I would call creators, enablers, or servers that were working in the real economy or made their names and reputations in the real world. What you see are largely resumes that consist exclusively, entirely, or largely of government work, working through government bureaucracies or institutions, as well as academia, a lot of academics and PhD economists. And there's nothing wrong with academia. It's a great background to have, or with government when suited to serve its mission. But exclusively having that to the degree that Fed leadership embraces, that creates, as I said, dangerous groupthink, where it becomes monopartisan or unipartisan. Everybody thinks the same way, does the same thing. Worst of all, perhaps, I mean, it's one thing to see negative real interest rates or zero interest rate free money policies for extended periods of time, well beyond any type of crisis that was used to justify it. It's another thing to see this this entrenched groupthink with everybody leading the Federal Reserve, having the same background, the same sort of lack of diversity of thought, so to speak. And it's another thing, of course, to see all the winners that are positioned to feed off of this type of a policy and who pays the price of it when it comes to individuals that are either retirees and pensions or mom and pop savers or your everyday creator, enabler, and server. But on top of all that, I think one of the biggest things that we should fear from the Fed and its current leadership is how it is continuing to push to expand its power and expand its scope and expand its control over the wider economy. How do you see the Federal Reserve growing its scope, its authority, its dominion over the rest of us? You see it everywhere. You can see it in the math. The Federal Reserve and its cohorts at other central banks across the globe, they have amassed a portfolio today where negative yielding debt is sitting at over $14 trillion globally. And you focus in upon the Fed itself within the United States, the Fed's collection of bonds, cash, and other holdings, it's projected to reach about $9 trillion by 2023. That's from the Fed itself, the Federal Reserve of New York. You compare that to where it's at now. I mentioned $7 trillion earlier. It's probably approaching $8 trillion toward the end of this year. And just to put that in perspective, it was $4 trillion at the end of February 2020. So once again, like we saw with the financial crisis of 08-09, the Fed and government loves to use a crisis and not let a good crisis go to waste. The COVID pandemic has really been a boon to the Fed, increasing its balance sheet and its control. And as I said earlier, its impact and dominion over the rest of us. You see this push with collaboration, coordination between government, the executive branch, the Biden administration, and the Fed. If you look at President Biden's budget that was published early in the summer here of 2021, it was assuming a lower for longer interest rate expense for the next 10 years. The budget that he presented had a 10-year Treasury note that was staying below the inflation rate through 2024. The Fed, on its part, said in speeches that, yeah, we're independent of the Treasury, but it reports to the Treasury Department. And I think the Fed is receiving a message, and they're receiving that message through the numbers in the Biden administration budget that are basically telling it what to do with the continued free money policy. You see the Fed push when it comes to little nuanced policy approaches or tactics that the Fed is applying. One of the best examples of recent note was where the Fed said it would no longer consider lags when making monetary policy. Now, forsaking that policy of preemption, that's what a whole bunch of Fed chairs prior to Powell have done through the years. Yellen applied it, Greenspan applied it, Bernanke applied it, Volcker. That concept of preemption, the tactic of it, was sort of an underpinning theory and practice that the Fed had employed for decades and decades. And by the way, this issue of no longer considering lags and doing away with the preemption tactic, that is something that no other major central bank is adopting or anything close to it. So the Fed stands alone on this issue. And really what it is a strategy or an approach of being late by design. They would want, or they're saying they're okay with inflation getting out of control before they would react and act with respect to rising or increasing interest rates. And again, using crises, emergencies to the benefit to grow your power via Fed or to have it set whatever policy would like for its other social objectives or cultural objectives with free money. That is a serious situation to embark upon, because you look at the concept of price controls, and it doesn't matter what type of an economist you are. Typically, economists wide and far have denounced price controls as being effective. But what the Fed is doing with its policies and the way it goes about its business and its mission of late is that it is really embracing the most important price control of all, which is long-term interest rates, because again, it controls the price of money. And once you control the price of money and you start playing with that, you control everything else, and you also amp up the risk for everyone throughout that economic ecosystem. And that, again, is true not just for the Fed and amping up its risk and its ability to deliver on its mission, but everybody that's tied to directly or indirectly with the economy at large. My fear, my concern of all this this pushing of Fed influence and impact across our economy is that the United States, and frankly, the globe at large, global markets, are going to find ourselves and themselves stuck in a debt trap. Now, what is a debt trap? It's basically a situation where this extended period of low interest rates, it catalyzes the buildup of so much unproductive government and private debt that when you get to that point to raise rates, if you were to raise rates, it would risk a collapse of the entire system, a catastrophic financial failure or a fiscal crisis. And central bankers will tell you that that's not the case, that they're confident and they'll never have to worry about the ability of a government, the U.S. government or any other government to fund itself. But the path there is one that is going to keep interest rates low for extended periods of time with no way out, because government, on the flip side, isn't about to tighten its purse strings and get into a financial house of order. It's going to continue to outspend and grow debt even further. And one player builds and eggs on the other to the point where they're both driving its government and the central bank to a bad outcome for everyone involved. We all become collateral damage. Now, there was a famous central banker, a governor, frankly, from the Bank of France. He once summed up, I think, in a brilliant manner, there were four uncertainties that all central bankers face. So he said the four were, first, they don't know where they are. Two, they don't know where they're going. Three, they are impacted by what others do, but they don't know what the others are going to do. And then last, they know there are structural changes, but they don't know what they are or what impacts they're going to have. I think that about sums up the ability of a central banker to apply a crystal ball and predict what it needs to do and where the economy should go. When you get to the bottom of the matter and the heart of it, the difference between the Fed's view of money and how the creator, the enabler, the server views money are very different, quite a contrast. For the Fed, the purpose of money is increasingly to effectuate social change. There's a social agenda, and they want to use money as a very effective way to effectuate that change in the short and in the long term. For the individual, the purpose of money is very different. It's to keep their hard-earned value through a stable and reliable currency. Not only are these two purposes different, my fear is that today they have become mutually exclusive, and they're battling with one another, they're conflicting with one another. So as we conclude this episode of the Far Middle podcast, let's talk about something that someone taught us, that's someone who we quoted at the beginning of our podcast, and that someone is Milton Friedman. He taught us that inflation and inevitable asset bubbles, they come invariably from monetary growth and excess or free money. It's a fact. It's going to happen. Only the federal government controls the money printing press. So as a result, government's going to have to bear full responsibility for inflation. But since government, at least in theory, hopefully still the case today, reports to answers to the people, the citizens, maybe it's time for us to take a more active and interested role in what, again, was once a nuanced, obtuse entity, the Federal Reserve, pay more attention to what it's doing and where it's going to ensure that it's pursuing a path and a mission that's consistent with the values that we hold near and dear to ourselves as creators, enablers, and servers. Well, as I said, that wraps up this episode of the Far Middle Podcast. I hope you've enjoyed it, and we'll be back in touch soon to discuss another exciting topic.